what happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. That's been a good thing for all of us, I think.
Yeah. Used to be. Wasn't it, Judge Kavanaugh?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica
with you.
Radio, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, now on WTPA News Radio, which used to be WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on KAKU. Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP. Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV. In Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountain, California on KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening pleasure on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have, for a change, a lot to cover on today's broadcast.
Oh, you say that to all the shows.
I do, don't I? That, of course, is the delightful Desi Doyen, who will be here for the entire hour if things go well. I appreciate the instinct for media outlets. Once the worst, most violent effects of a major storm have died down, to, you know, want to move on to other things. That reaction is certainly even more understandable, I guess, sort of, right now, given all of the other things, including allegations of attempted rape against a U.S. Supreme Court nominee and historic midterm elections that are now just over 5 weeks away. And we will cover those things in a moment as well. But people are still dying and suffering and being threatened from the continuing effects of Hurricane Florence in the Carolinas and nearby states, and with the nearly 3,000 deaths after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, we should be reminded that much of the threat of these sorts of storms can come after the winds have passed. To that end, yes, we are still keeping our eyes on this ongoing disaster and will continue to do so as we can. So at least a quick update before we get to everything else today from Hurricane Florence. The death toll has now climbed to at least 37 as of Wednesday afternoon, including two mental health patients who drowned when a sheriff's van was swept away by floodwaters. And North Carolina's governor has continued to plead with thousands of evacuees to not yet return home just yet. At the same time, President Donald Trump arrived in storm-ravaged North Carolina on Wednesday, visiting a church in the hard-hit coastal town of New Bern, where volunteers have been handing out food to storm victims. No word on how many rolls of paper towels he threw to the suffering residents, but I guess he showed up. I guess that's something. Wilmington, which has a population of 120,000, is still mostly an island right now, surrounded by floodwaters, and people continue to wait for hours for handouts of food and water and tarps. Thousands of others around the state are still in shelters waiting for the all clear. After submerging North Carolina with nearly 3 feet of rain, The storm dumped more than 6.5 inches of rain in the Northeast, where it's causing problems in other states, including flash flooding. North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper warned that the flooding in North Carolina is still far from over and will get worse in some places, he said on Wednesday. Addressing roughly 10,000 people who remain in shelters and countless more who are staying elsewhere, Cooper urged those folks to stay put for now, particularly those from the hardest hit coastal counties. Roads remain treacherous, he said. Some are still being closed for the first time, as rivers are swelling still around the state. But the risk of environmental damage now is growing as both human and animal waste is washing into the swirling floodwaters. More than 5 million gallons of partially treated sewage spilled into the Cape Fear River after power went out at a treatment plant. Why there wasn't backup power at that treatment plant, or why the backup power, if they had it, went out, I'm not yet sure, but that's not good. Officials also said that the earthen dam of a pond holding hog waste was breached, spilling its contents, according to AP, and the flooding killed an estimated, so far, 3.5 million chickens and 55 hogs on farms. Zoe Schlanger over at Environmental Reporter over at Quartz updates us now with the late numbers from the state late today on the what she calls the hog poop lagoons. 21, she says, according to state data, have poop flowing out of them. 67 are likely to overflow very soon. 17 are already flooded. And 5 have been structurally breached.
And that's really what is one of the long-term public health hazards of these storms, particularly with Florence, with so many toxic coal ash waste sites that have been inundated and are adding to the floodwaters, the hog manure lagoons, the dead livestock, those that drowned, trapped in those massive barns. I've been seeing photos and videos of people playing in the floodwaters. No. I don't think it's getting out to the people that live there that, hey, those waters are toxic. They're contaminated with both human and animal sewage. They should be avoided as much as possible.
And there's going to be the task of cleaning up 3.5 million dead chickens and 5,500 dead pigs, which caused in, Hurricane Matthew just a couple of years ago caused, it was a huge task and very difficult and very toxic and smelly trying to clean up from that storm. And this one is
This one's still ongoing.
This is ongoing, and it's worse.
And the standing waters that will take, you know, weeks for these floodwaters to potentially recede, that means a lot of standing water. That means mosquitoes and mosquito-borne diseases.
So I hope the media can find it in them to at least keep an eye on what is going on right now from the fallout of Florence and will continue to be going on for quite some time. Brandon Echevarrieta was interviewed by the Associated Press, and they say he struggled to stay composed as he described life post-Florence. No power for days. Rotted meat in the freezer. No water or food, and just one bath in a week. The 34-year-old said with his voice breaking that it has been pretty bad. So we continue to send our best wishes to the folks out there still fighting this, and they will still be fighting it for quite a while, I suspect. All right. Well, it is also impossible right now to keep up with all of the noise and the still very quickly moving and changing developments following the serious allegation of attempted rape leveled against federal appeals court judge and nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. But Greg Sargent of Plumline, as usual, cuts to the central heart of the matter, at least at this hour. So I'm going to try to work from some of his column here at the Washington Post's Plumline today. The Republican strategy to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed is to do the absolute minimum necessary to appear as if they are taking the sexual assault charges against him seriously while doing all that they can to limit the ability of the American people to make a fully informed judgment about those charges themselves. That sounds about right. The words and actions of Republicans themselves, he notes, confirm the rationale behind this strategy. Any delay and further fact-finding into this might make it less likely that Kavanaugh gets confirmed and could threaten more political damage to the GOP's chances in the upcoming midterms. And if confirmation is delayed past the election and Democrats somehow do manage to win back a majority in the U.S. Senate, that throws the seat's fate into doubt big time. On Tuesday night, just after we got off air, Christine Blasey Ford's lawyer, she's the accuser here, sent a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee demanding an FBI investigation into her allegations against Kavanaugh before she testifies to the committee, as Republicans have invited her to do next Monday. In the letter, Ford's legal team notes that since she came forward, she has been the target of, quote, vicious harassment and, quote, death threats, that she's had to leave her home to keep her family safe, and argues that an FBI probe is necessary because some Republican senators have already made up their minds that she is simply, quote, mistaken and, quote, mixed up. Mistaken and mixed up about who tried to rape her some 30 years ago when she was in high school. Mistaken and mixed up were the words that Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, used. And now other Republicans have decided to claim, with no evidence to support that conclusion whatsoever, that she's just mixed up. It must have been someone else. It couldn't have been Brett Kavanaugh. But remember Orrin Hatch's name here for a moment. We'll return to him in a moment. Dr. Ford's lawyers wrote in their letter to the committee, quote, a full investigation by law enforcement officials will ensure that the crucial facts and witnesses in this matter are assessed in a nonpartisan manner and that the committee is fully informed before conducting any hearing, adding that no serious investigation can be conducted by Monday, which is when Republicans have scheduled the hearing at which she and Kavanaugh, and currently only she and Kavanaugh, no other witnesses, including the man Mark Judge, who was said to have been in the room and participated in the attack at that time, only she and Kavanaugh would testify as things are set right now by the Senate Republicans. That man, Mark Judge, for his part, after denying the attack, now says he doesn't remember any such incident. So maybe there was an attack, but he doesn't remember it if it happened. By the way, Mark Judge has written for right-wing outlets like Daily Caller and so forth. So he, too, is a right-winger, just like Kavanaugh. He says he doesn't remember any such incident, and he has said that he has no interest in testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, though, of course, the committee could subpoena him and require him to do so, especially since he has no Fifth Amendment right to protect himself here at all, given that the statute of limitations for a criminal prosecution for this assault, that has long passed. So he would have to answer these questions before the Judiciary Committee. So no wonder he doesn't want to speak to them. But, you know, why would he be afraid of doing that if he knows nothing about any of this? Of course, since Republicans don't really want to know what went on here, Mark Judge has not even been invited to appear, much less subpoenaed to do so, as he could be. Republican senators are flatly rejecting the demands by Dr. Blasey Ford and by Democrats for an FBI investigation. Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, said, quote, we've offered Dr. Ford the opportunity to share her story with the committee, and the invitation for Monday still stands. That's it. Bob Corker of Tennessee. Remember him, the one who was supposedly an opponent of Donald Trump's? He claimed, quote, Republicans extended a hand in good faith. If we don't hear from both sides on Monday, let's vote. He doesn't care. He has no interest getting to the truth before seating this guy on the highest court in the land. He could not care less. People who regard Bob Corker as some sort of a hero for occasionally very softly speaking out about Donald Trump, Bob Corker is no hero. John Cornyn of Texas, of course, we know he's no hero. Speaking yesterday, he remarked glibly, quote, she's not really in a position to make conditions, in my view. Right. She's just the attempted rape victim here. What right does she have to give any conditions about when she comes out and speaks to the world about what she says happened to her? And what right does she have to make any demands that officials actually investigate what is a criminal matter, or at least what would have been had the statute of limitations not run out? But here's the central part of the matter. Why is it that the hearing cannot simply be delayed past Monday? On Wednesday morning, Senator Lindsey Graham gave the game away in a couple of tweets in which he may not have meant to, but as Sergeant quotes, Graham said, quote, requiring an FBI investigation of a 36-year-old allegation before Professor Ford will appear before the Judiciary Committee is not about finding the truth, but delaying the process till after the midterm elections. In a second tweet, he added, it is imperative that the Judiciary Committee move forward on the Kavanaugh nomination and a committee vote be taken ASAP. It's imperative. Now, Graham does not say why a Judiciary Committee vote must take place ASAP, but the first tweet does make that clear. An investigation might end up, quote, delaying the process till after the midterms. Graham blames Democrats for wanting to do this, but what Graham doesn't explain here is why the fact that this could be delayed until after the midterm should place any limits whatsoever on the Senate's efforts to determine what actually happened here. And, of course, that's because the real answer is that it's untenable as a public position to say that out loud. Because if this is delayed until after the midterms and Republicans happen to lose control of the Senate, then they would have to confirm the justice in a lame duck period, which, as Brian Buettler points out, President Trump would be badly weakened in that situation, and this would further cast a cloud of illegitimacy over the process of filling the seat, whether it's filled with Kavanaugh or anyone else at that point, and would compound the legitimacy problem that whoever the justice was would end up then ruling on matters relating to Trump's legal problems. The Wall Street Journal editorial board is helpfully explicit on the real calculus here. They warn, quote, if Democrats take the Senate majority, they'll then insist on no vote until the new Senate convenes in January, which they should. And frankly, they should have already done that. Of course, Republicans would not listen to any of that. And all of which basically concedes that moving forward at this point puts them in a politically brutal position, so they want to get it done as soon as possible. ASAP, as Lindsey Graham said. And not that they care, by the way, about being in a politically brutal position. Not that that would slow them down one bit, even with the results being, you know, ultimately not one, but two alleged Republican sexual assaulters on a 9-member U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, that's what all of this is about. That's the rush. There is zero other reason for the panic currently shaking both the White House and Capitol Hill over Kavanaugh's nomination. There are a few cases that may not go the Republicans' way. If there's a delay because there's maybe a 4-4 split on the court until they can get their swing vote onto the already stolen Supreme Court, but the fear that they could be blocked entirely from doing so. And frankly, if the Democrats take back the majority here, they would be within their rights to not only stall any nomination to the Supreme Court, but block one for 2 years and keep it a 4-4 court for the next 2 years until after the next presidential election, or as Mitch McConnell used to like saying, until after the American people have had a voice in this decision. Sargent concedes the Democrats, of course, may well want to delay this until after the midterms, but even if that is true, the fact that Republicans are citing this is revealing. The fact that they're, you know, pointing to Democrats wanting to delay it. Republicans, after all, they could support a fuller investigation into what happened and still vote before the midterm elections. There is still time for both an investigation and testimony and a vote before November 6. The only thing that would delay this until after the election is if Kavanaugh's nomination becomes untenable because that fuller investigation actually happens and we learn more about all of this and what actually happened. And that might force Trump to then have to nominate a replacement. That would definitely push things until after the election. Thus, Sargent concludes, that is really what they want to avoid, a fuller accounting that could scuttle this nomination entirely, which means they would not be able to get anyone seated before November 6. That's what this is all about. Period. End of story. They don't give a damn about what actually happened to this woman 36 years ago. They don't actually give a damn about waiting to find out her story, about investigating what happened here. They do not want to hear from any more people. They do not want to hear from any more witnesses. On Facebook on Wednesday, a former schoolmate of Christine Blasey Ford posted a note in support of her, writing, among other things, quote, "Christine Blasey Ford was a year or so behind me. I remember her. This incident did happen. Many of us heard about it in school, and Christine's recollection should be more than enough for us to truly deeply know what the note, to truly deeply know that the accusation is true." This woman, Christina King, former schoolmate of Ford's, later took down the post after being besieged by media and others, and said that while she does not have firsthand personal knowledge of the incident, she stands by her support for Christine. That's just one of perhaps dozens or even hundreds of various witnesses in varying capacities to all of this that the GOP does not want to come out. And it's the reason why they are not waiting for an FBI investigation, and it's why the White House has not asked the FBI to do one, as the George H.W. Bush White House did. They did request an FBI investigation in the case of allegations of sexual impropriety by their then Republican Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas back in 1991. For the record, just under 600 women alumni of the high school that Christine Blasey Ford attended in Bethesda, Maryland, have now signed an open letter indicating their support for the woman who has accused Kavanaugh of attempted rape back in high school, according to Vox News. That comes in response to the 65 women who signed on to a letter in support of Kavanaugh that Chuck Grassley, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was somehow magically able to produce within hours after the allegations came to light on Monday. Those women, those 65 women, claimed that because Kavanaugh did not attempt, I guess, to rape them, he couldn't have possibly attempted to rape anyone else. You know, he treated them fine, so she must be lying. As to the FBI investigation, or the lack thereof in this case, Grassley on Wednesday once again said that Ford should consider a hearing that he has scheduled for Monday. her only opportunity to air her allegations, apparently. That Grassley wrote in a letter responding to her attorneys on Wednesday afternoon. Grassley lied in the letter that it's not the FBI's role to investigate a matter such as this. He said that they have no power in the Senate to order the FBI to investigate. That is true. They can't unilaterally do so. They can't order the FBI to conduct a background check style investigation here, but there is nothing stopping Donald Trump from instructing the FBI to do exactly that, just as George Bush Sr. did 30 years ago. And that is a point that even Utah's right-wing Judiciary Committee member, Senator Orrin Hatch, even he agrees with that. Even he agrees that the FBI could and should investigate this matter. Orrin Hatch. Or at least he used to agree with it. He did back in 1991 during the Anita Hill hearings for Clarence Thomas. As Steve Dennis of Bloomberg tweeted out today, from the transcript of those hearings some 30 years ago, and we didn't have time to track down the audio, but here's the quote. This was back when Orrin Hatch was also on the committee, on the judiciary. He's on it now. He was on it 30 years ago. And Hatch said to Anita Hill at the time, according to the transcript, quote, Chairman Biden and Ranking Member Thurmond, when they heard about this the first time, they immediately ordered this FBI investigation, which was the very right thing to do. And they did what every other chairman and ranking member have done. So, back in 1991, it was the right thing to do to order an FBI investigation. And every other chair and ranking member would have done the same, did in fact do the same. That was Orrin Hatch back in 1991. Orrin Hatch today, he wants to get this over with ASAP. He's not calling for an FBI investigation. Steve Dennis at Bloomberg asks if this was, quote, the very right thing to do for the chairman and ranking member in 91 to ask for an FBI investigation in Anita Hill's case. Why is it not now? Well, we know the answer to that. It's because the Republicans do not want to know what actually happened, period. And I suspect they wouldn't have wanted to know back in 1991, except back then the committee was headed up by Democrats. In that case, it was Joe Biden. As Bloomberg reports today, the FBI could investigate Kavanaugh allegations, but the White House is not asking the Bureau to do so. So that's where we are at this moment. And it all could change by the time you listen to today's show, but that's where we are at this hour and what the headwinds are likely to be for the next several days as Republicans desperately try to do the absolute minimum they can do, the minimum that they can get away with without appearing to attack Dr. Ford herself. And by the way, all of this should be very good news for the Catholic Church. This should be great news.
How so?
Well, they can stop worrying about all of the sexual assault cases from decades ago. Those were decades ago. We don't need to worry about those. We don't need to investigate those. They can stop paying millions of dollars in settlements. They can stop forcing the resignations of those priests who were involved in them because, you know, if enough time passes, the perps, everybody knows, according to Senate Republicans anyway, the perps get a get-out-of-jail-free card if they can wait long enough. And not only get-out-of-jail-free, those priests should be promoted. They can be promoting the sexual assaulters again. I don't know why the Catholic Church is so worried about all of this. Just promote them, just as the Republicans are planning to do, hoping to do with Brett Kavanaugh, to give him a lifetime appointment to the swing vote seat on the highest court in the land. See? Don't worry, Catholics. Everything is all right. Okay, quick break, and we'll hit some news about that upcoming election that Republicans really hope doesn't get here very soon because the news does not look good for them in that regard either. We'll talk about that. Oh, and some other breaking news out of Alabama today. From my friend, Secretary of State John Merrill. All of that and more ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, well, let me start with this, because this was just breaking. Everything's just breaking before airtime these days. But last May, you may remember, before the primary elections in Alabama, I had a wildly bizarre exchange with the Alabama Secretary of State, John Merrill, on Twitter, where I very politely had asked him about an erroneous claim that he had made on Twitter regarding the state's voting systems and whether or not they produced a digital ballot image of scanned ballots and so forth. I won't go into the details. They do produce that image, but he claimed over and over again that they do not and they could not, and he was wrong, and I politely said as much to him. And I was subsequently banned from following his Twitter account, where he talks about elections and, you know, the stuff that we cover on this show, that I cover as a journalist. I can no longer at least easily follow what the Secretary of State of Alabama has to say about such things. But, of course, I had esteemed company at the time. Other election experts, such as UC Irvine's election law professor Rick Hassan and University of Kentucky's Joshua Douglas, who joined us on the show to talk about it. They were also banned by Merrill from following his account, even though it's important to all of our jobs to be able to do that. I also found that Merrill had similarly banned tons and tons of his own constituents as well, because he just didn't like hearing from them. Then in a federal case against Donald Trump by several Twitter users that Trump had banned himself, a federal judge found that Trump was violating their First Amendment constitutional rights and ordered Trump to reinstate those banned Twitter users. I asked John Merrill, Secretary of State of Alabama, I asked his office if he planned after that federal court ruling to unban those who he had banned, and they said absolutely not. Well, this so-called conservative Republican, John Merrill, who is facing a challenge, by the way, this year, this November, from Democratic Secretary of State candidate Heather Milam. This so-called conservative must now waste who knows how much in taxpayer dollars defending his idiocy of blocking people on Twitter that he does not agree with. According to AL.com today, three Alabama citizens are now suing Secretary of State John Merrill for blocking them on Twitter. The three registered voters claim in the complaint filed on their behalf by the American Civil Liberties Union of Alabama that Merrill violated their First Amendment rights by blocking them from interacting with his official John H. Merrill account on Twitter. Brock Boone, an attorney with the ACLU of Alabama, described the move by Merrill as a violation of the First Amendment that amounts to a decision to, quote, discriminate against his own constituents. Boone says when a government official intentionally opens up a public conversation, that official can't block individuals from joining the conversation because of the views that are expressed. Merrill also spoke with AL.com Wednesday morning. He was predictably defiant about the lawsuit, which he called a, quote, political hack job. As he is a political hack, I guess he would know. By the way,
does he ever think about these things before he says them?
I never called him a political hack. I was nothing but polite to him. I'll link to our conversation that we had that resulted in me getting banned. I've seen other conversations that others had with him that, were very polite and were not political. There was nothing political about my tweets at all to him or those of Hassan's or Douglas that resulted in all of us getting banned by him. And as the federal suit against Donald Trump showed, Merrill simply could have just muted the conversations from people like me. If he didn't want to hear it, he wouldn't see it at all. But at least we would still be able to see what he had to say and participate in conversation about that. But he cannot block people like that if he is using his account for his official role as Secretary of State, which he is, at least according to the other federal court. I think that was in New York. We'll see what this one has to say. The Montgomery Advertiser reported back in June, after I had made a lot of noise about what Merrill was doing, that Merrill said that he addressed the topic of the blocking people on Twitter after that Trump ruling that I had asked them about, and whether they now intended to unblock people. He said at the time, "I'm not unblocking anybody that I've already blocked, because there's a reason those people were blocked. And anyone else that I feel needs to be blocked in the future will also be blocked," he said back then, according to the Advertiser, which sounds exactly like what his office told me. The three plaintiffs in this new ACLU case against Merrill that is now before the U.S. District Court of Alabama's Middle District claim that Merrill violated their First Amendment rights. Kimberly Fasking, a student at Samford University's Cumberland School of Law, says that Merrill blocked her after she tweeted a question about crossover voting. Alabama resident Heather Melvin Booth claims in the complaint that she was, quote, blocked for stating, "Good point, ballot has major typo." And she got blocked for that. And Alabama farmer and educator Herbert Hicks said he was blocked after asking Merrill about a speaking engagement. Fasking said that she was disappointed by the decision to block her and said in a statement, "It is upsetting to me that the Secretary of State, who primarily uses his Twitter account to disseminate information on issues related to his office, has also weaponized that account by blocking those with whom he disagrees politically. It is not the Secretary of State's job to communicate only with those who agree with him, but with all of the people of the state of Alabama." According to the complaint, Merrill blocking the Twitter users, quote, imposes an unconstitutional restriction on their participation in a designated public forum. It imposes an unconstitutional restriction on their right to access statements that defendants are otherwise making available to the public at large. It imposes an unconstitutional restriction on their right to petition the government for redress of grievances. Merrill rejects that argument, you'll be shocked, and blames the controversy on partisan politics.
Well, of course, because that's the only thing he has left. I mean, he's actually preventing his constituents, voters who are registered in Alabama, from getting official communications from the Secretary of State about their voting and what the state is doing for the election coming up. It's really remarkable he thinks he can get away with that.
Well, he has gotten away with it so far, but now he's going to have to defend it in a court of law, and those very constituents who are being blocked are going to be paying for his defense, apparently, in this stupid case. Again, he has every ability to not see what people say to him by simply muting those users. But he will not do that. Anyway, for the record, by the way, I'm also blocked. Well, there's a lot of right-wingers who block me, but when it comes to public officials, I'm also blocked by Ohio's Republican Secretary of State, John Husted. I have no idea why in that case. Suddenly, just one day, I tried to look up what comment he was saying on Twitter, and I was told I was blocked. Of course, that makes my job as a journalist, particularly as an election integrity journalist, all the more difficult as we head towards the November 6th primary. So no idea what's going on in Ohio from the Secretary of State, well, at least what he's tweeting about. And I have no idea why, but frankly, I hope the ACLU will sue John Husted as well. Okay, well, here's some, I think that's pretty good news, and here's some additional good news, some certainly good news. Advocacy groups pouring money into independent campaigns to impact this fall's midterm races must now disclose many, if not all, of their political donors beginning this week. That thanks to a decision by the Supreme Court on Tuesday, who declined to intervene in a long-running case. This may just be one of the reasons why Republicans are desperate to get Kavanaugh on that court. In this case, the High Court would not grant an emergency request to stay a ruling by a federal judge in Washington who had thrown out a decades-old Federal Election Commission regulation allowing certain nonprofit groups to keep their donors secret, certain dark money groups. As you have heard about, as we talk about, as the Citizens United case back in 2010 allowed these dark money groups to just pour millions, if not billions, into our election system. With less than 50 days before this fall's congressional elections, the ruling has far-reaching consequences, Washington Post reports, that could curtail the ability of major political players to raise money and force the disclosure of some of the country's wealthiest donors. Good. In an interview, the chair of the FEC chairwoman and, yes, GOP operative Caroline Hunter, said that the names of certain contributors who give money to nonprofit groups to use in political campaigns beginning Wednesday will have to be publicly reported. Good. Hunter and other so-called conservatives, as the Washington Post describes them, warned the decision could have a chilling effect just as the midterms are heating up. She said, quote, "It's unfortunate that citizens and groups who wish to advocate for their candidates will now have to deal with a lot of uncertainty less than 2 months before the election," said Hunter, a Republican employee. Well, yeah, that too, but Republican appointee to the FEC. It's terribly unfortunate, Caroline, that folks will actually have to be transparent when spending millions of dollars to buy our elections. So sad. Terribly unfortunate that we should know who it is. If you're exercising your First Amendment rights, that we should know who that person is who is exercising that right in an election by spending millions of dollars. That I cannot, by the way, I cannot compete with. I don't have millions of dollars to spend on elections. But a whole bunch of secret millionaires and billionaires do. Well, now those secret millionaires and billionaires are going to be known, at least in a few cases here. Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, said this is a great day for transparency and democracy. Said we're about to know a lot more about who is funding our elections. I'd say who is buying our elections, but I take Noah's point. The ruling last month, in this case by a Chief U.S. District Judge Beryl A. Howell, will be challenged on appeal. So this still could change, but in the immediate, the decision will now force major groups on the left and the right to scramble to reassess how they're going to finance the fall campaign. Nonprofit advocacy groups, which do not have to publicly disclose their donors as political committees do, will now have to begin doing so. They'll now have to begin reporting the names of contributors who give more than $200 per year towards their independent political campaigns. That change, the Post notes, could affect heavyweight groups across the political spectrum, including the Koch-backed Americans for Prosperity on the right and the League of Conservation Voters on the left. Of course, the Kochs spend far more money than the groups on the left, but, you know, even Steven, it's going to affect everyone the same way, says the Washington Post. This case began nearly 6 years ago when CREW filed a complaint to the FEC. We have been covering it for all of those years and longer, this particular case.
It's amazing and I suppose helpful to let people know that these take a long time to resolve. And it's a long time getting through the judicial system. The litigation takes time to resolve, but, you know, hopefully in the long run, justice wins out.
If we have a long run at this point, the way things are going. Back then, the original complaint argued that the FEC should require Crossroads GPS.
Karl Rove's outfit.
Yes. That they had to disclose the names of their donors behind a $6 million effort. It ran in 2012 against Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown in Ohio. So, at the time, the FEC deadlocked on whether they should open an investigation into Crossroads, despite the findings of the FEC's own investigators that, yes, the bulk of the money spent by Crossroads was on political advocacy. But the way the FEC is built with a 3-3 Democratic-Republican split, and over the past decade or so, the Republicans have used that their three seats essentially to keep anything from being investigated, at least anything that would help them. It used to be that they would work together on the FEC, but the Republicans have, of course, politicized that to the point of it really being damn near useless at this point.
They've pretty much weaponized the FEC.
They weaponize everything. That's what they do. They are not a legitimate political party. They don't have legitimate political ideas. They are simply there to weaponize whatever power they can have to get more power behind them, to help their corporate friends and their secret money donors, who at least will now be somewhat less secret. So the district court ruling, said that those have to be, that the FEC's regulations, that those groups did not have to reveal. And these are just regulations. These aren't laws. But FEC's regulation that these people did not have to reveal their donors, the judge said that regulation, quote, blatantly undercuts the congressional goal of fully disclosing the sources of money flowing into federal political campaigns and thereby suppresses the benefits intended to accrue from disclosure. She had delayed that disclosure requirement for 45 days to give the FEC time to write a new rule. They didn't. And now Crossroads unsuccessfully sought to stay her ruling pending an appeal to the ruling. But now the Supreme Court says, nope, it's going to go into effect as of now. And we'll see if there's an appeal later. The development has set off a frenzy among nonprofit groups as they try to make sense of what this ruling means and doesn't for fundraising and spending activity for the 2018 election. Yes, chaos lies ahead. Jessica Levinson, however, election law professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, said the Supreme Court's order is, quote, a huge win for the public. We will take whatever huge wins we can get. All right, let me take a quick break. We'll come back with some more good news, believe it or not, regarding elections. That's after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Rolling ahead, I'm Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. So, as I promised, some good news, some more good news today amidst everything else. In California, according to the Secretary of State's office, over 25,000 residents had their ballots thrown away and not counted at all back in the November 2016 general election cycle. That's not the good news. I'm getting to the good news in a second. Those 25,000 ballots were thrown out because of a mismatching signature on them. The voter signature on the ballot did not match what was in their voter registration file, and election officials decided, you know what, these don't matter. These must be fraudulent. I'm just going to throw them away. Mismatching signatures, however, can occur for a number of reasons above and beyond fraud. And in California, there is no law that, or there had been no law that mandates local election officials actually notify voters that their ballots are going to be tossed out, or provide them with an opportunity to correct the mistake. Well, SB 759, or the Every Vote Counts bill, passed the California State Legislature a few weeks ago. We noted it at the time. It establishes the process for election officials to notify voters when their vote-by-mail ballot, when the signature on it is a mismatch from the one on file. Specifically, the bill requires election officials to notify voters that the signature doesn't match the one on file at least 8 days prior to the certification of an election so that voters have an opportunity to verify their signature, to say, yeah, that is my signature. That is my ballot. Please count it. Don't throw it away without telling me. According to a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU last year, there are a number of reasons why signatures may not match. For example, a person may have a disability that they may not have had when they originally registered to vote. Their ability may change or make it difficult to match the signature because of a shaky hand. A different member of the household, like a spouse or a caretaker, might have signed the ballot. A voter's signature can change or evolve over time, or the person, such as someone whose second language is English, may be unaware that they have to sign their ballot the same way that it is on the file, and they sign in the characters of a non-English alphabet or something like that. All kinds of reasons. So SB 759 was passed a few weeks ago, and the good news coming from Jim Soper late yesterday, Jim, we've had him on the show many times, from the Voting Rights Task Force, the California Election Protection Network. He writes in to say that Governor Brown has now signed this bill and that it will make significant changes to the signature verification procedures for vote-by-mail envelopes.
That is good news.
That is good news.
Good news for voters.
Good news for voters, for all voters, and alleviates, well, at least one of the many concerns that I have regarding vote-by-mail.
At least in California.
At least in California. And I don't know how many other states where they can simply throw out ballots if they want to without notifying the voters and giving them a chance to do something about
Remarkably,
it
has to be put into the law to force election officials to notify voters first before they toss the ballot. Seems like that would be...
Common sense.
Common sense, you know, something that would they would do automatically, but no.
All right, got some good news for Democrats in a number of states. Democrat Tony Evers is pulling ahead of Scott Walker in the race to become Wisconsin's next governor. That, according to the Marquette University Law School poll released this week, the Marquette poll is considered to be the gold standard for election polling in Wisconsin. Evers earned 49% of support among likely voters compared to 44% for Scott Walker. It's the first time since Evers won the nomination in August that he has led Walker in the Marquette poll. Last month, the two nominees were tied at 46%. Walker previously won his seat in GOP wave years, and his crackdown on voting rights and cuts to the state education budget have hurt him in Wisconsin. Support for Evers, the state school superintendent, appears to be bolstered by independent voters. According to Marquette, GOP support for Walker and Democratic support for Evers are both over 90%, but among independents, the breakdown is 52% for Evers and just 32% for Walker, a 20-point split among independents in Wisconsin in the governor's race. Results also from Marquette look good for Democrats in the U.S. Senate race, with incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin expanding her lead from 2 points to 11 in her race against the GOP challenger Leah Vukmir. Baldwin earned 53% of likely voters compared to 42% for Vukmir. Let's see. Do I have some? Okay, I got time for a little bit more good news for Democrats and bad news for Republican gubernatorial candidates. Former Senator Nancy Kassebaum in Kansas, a Republican and a political trailblazer who represented Kansas in the U.S. Senate from 1978 to 1997, she announced on Tuesday that she would support Laura Kelly, the Democratic candidate for governor in this year's election, rather than Republican nominee Secretary of State Kris Kobach.
Wait, so the Republican is endorsing the Democrat?
Correct.
Wow.
And she's not the only one, by the way, in Kansas, not the only Republican. She says, I'm a Republican, but that doesn't mean you walk lockstep always with the party. According to the Kansas City Star, she says, it seems to me that Kobach has developed a record that shows a focus on ways to accomplish his end goals that I think are not the best for Kansas. This is very polite. Dozens of other high-ranking Kansas Republicans in the state have also backed the Democrat Kelly, including the state's former Governor Bill Graves and former Senator and Lieutenant Governor Sheila Fromm. It has three, a Republican, a Democrat, and an Independent who is siphoning off votes right now from the Democrat. So Kobach still has a very good chance to win the controversial and, frankly, embarrassing for the state of Kansas, Chris Kobach. But yet another endorsement for the Democrat here from a high-ranking Republican could make a difference on November 6th.
Wow. And you know, of course, the thing that will really make the difference on November 6th is turnout. And voter turnout has to also be greater than the margin of voter suppression, especially in many of these red states where gerrymandering, photo ID restrictions, any number of dirty tricks are all going to come to fore in preventing people from voting.
Turnout and the ability to count those voters who do turn out and are managed to have their vote counted as cast, not necessarily easy in Chris Kobach's state of Kansas, where Chris Kobach is overseeing his own election for governor as the state's top election official as Secretary of State. We'll continue to keep our eyes on that and much more in the days ahead, but we got to get out today. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is appreciated more than you can know. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters where I am The Brad Blog, and you can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And finally, my thanks to those of you who keep us going by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. We need your support there now more than ever. bradblog.com/donate. If you'd like the broadcast to keep going, we've been fighting to continue through this year's midterm elections. We just may make it. Thank you. All right. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.